Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein Online. It's Monday, October 13th, 2008. The only October 13th, 2008 in the history of the world. Welcome in on this first day of the work week. Glad to have you along. Whether you're listening live or on the archive, we are happy to have you on the webcast known as Glenn Klein Online, coming to you from the undisclosed location in northern Wisconsin, about 3 weeks prior to the United States presidential election. And we wanted to talk a little bit about politics tonight, a little bit about what's been happening in the economy, not only in this country, but worldwide. And I could think of no better person to have for you beautiful humans to hear tonight. You've heard him before, one of the outstanding libertarian thinkers in this part of the country, Mr. Brian Pitlick, the president of Pitlick & Witt. Brian, how are you this evening?
I'm doing great, Glenn.
So happy to have you with us.
It's good to be here, second time around.
Well, you know, you never forget your first time, Brian, but we are really happy to have you. And as you folks know that have listened to this webcast on a regular basis, that we really base everything that we do on a mindset of establishing as much freedom in whatever dynamic we're in. And, you know, Brian, the libertarian position is way more than just the Libertarian Party. Bob Barr, the former Georgia congressman, is running as a presidential candidate in the Libertarian Party, but he was a Republican, and really, under Newt Gingrich in the Republican Congress, he was as much a part of the problem. Now, he's been talking a good game, but libertarianism is way more than just the Libertarian Party.
Well, that's right. It's really the way you think and the way you live. It's hard to watch somebody that was in the Republican Congress during all those years when the problems that we have now were created and really believe that they truly understand and believe in the libertarian philosophy.
Do you really believe that the problems started when Bill Clinton was president and the Republican Party took over the Congress for the first time in 40 years in 1994?
Well, the economic problems we have certainly can be, a large portion of those can be traced back to that time period. The roots, of course, go back earlier than that, probably in the 30s during the last Great Depression, but definitely in the 90s they accelerated.
This is Glenn Klein Online. We're talking with Brian Pitlick about politics, about the presidential election, about the economy. Just for folks who may not have heard the previous program, Brian, or might not even be familiar with the term libertarian, how would you define somebody who says, like we do, that we're libertarians? How would you define that term?
Well, I think the most basic definition is that you believe in social liberalism. It's not that you may practice it, but you believe in the rights of others. And you would most likely be fiscally conservative, and you would trace all of that back to the principles that this country was founded on, the Constitution.
I think that that is such a foundational and fundamental point about libertarian thinking, is that we recognize that there was a founding document. And if you're going to have a documentation of how the laws are supposed to be passed and how the government is supposed to be run, either follow that document or don't have it.
Or change it if you don't like it. That's the process, you know, that's the education process that's supposed to occur. If you don't like something in the Constitution, they've amended it before. It promotes good discussion, and you have a discourse among differing viewpoints, and you come out with the best outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, is that the Constitution itself set up a system where it could be changed. I mean, really, I mean, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution was really an inspired concept. And even the fact that they understood that there was going to be things that they could not foresee, they put a provision in there that allowed for the amending of the Constitution. But what we've seen in our government, in I think one of the most heinous examples, is the fact that Congress is supposed to be the ones to declare war. We haven't had a constitutional war in this country since World War II.
Right, and through the Vietnam War and the incursions into Iraq and Kuwait, and now with the latest bailout bill, you know, a lot of that was unconstitutional as well, giving the Federal Reserve and the Treasury secretary more powers that they don't have, according to the Constitution.
You know, people, I think, don't realize that the Constitution actually says that Congress cannot pass any laws that the Constitution says it can't, but it has happened throughout history. It's ironic that in the early part of the last century, they had to pass a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol and then, of course, repeal that amendment. But for some reason, no constitutional amendment to make marijuana illegal and other drugs illegal. It just happened one day.
Yeah, as time progresses, it just continually erodes. We're at the point now where the Constitution is really totally disregarded. It's not even considered in the lawmaking process. And you can take the point that, you know, all the rights not reserved to Congress then go to the states or to the people. And that is basically ignored. You basically now have no rights unless they are granted to you by the government, which is directly opposite to the principles that this country was founded on.
You know, after September 11th, 2001, I was doing co-hosting a radio show with Harry Brown, who, of course, was the past presidential candidate in 96 and 2000 for the Libertarian Party. And then after the election, when Bush was elected and won the Supreme Court case, and 9/11 happened, Harry and I had just started doing a radio show. And it was the Harry Brown Show, and I was his sidekick. And 9/11 happened on a Tuesday, and our show was on Friday night. And Harry said, it was prophetic. I mean, and Harry, you know, and may he rest in peace, passed away about 2 years ago from Lou Gehrig's disease. But what a tremendous statesman and tremendous person. But he, Brian, he predicted exactly what was going to happen. And not only did he predict exactly what Bush's response would be, what the Congress's response would be, what the public's response would be, he also said what should happen, which was this was a mass murder and that it should be treated as such. This was not a military matter. And basically what we have now, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, is our military bogged down. We don't have any options in Iran because of that. And we are really up at Schitt's Creek without a paddle. And you in the same way that Harry predicted what would happen after 9/11, and he said, by the way, he said that if Al Gore was president, the same thing would happen, of course. But for years, you've been talking to me about an economic collapse that was going to occur. And I would hear you, and I would listen to you, and because I respect you so much, but it hadn't happened. And, of course, just in the last week or so, we've seen an economic worldwide meltdown. What was the thinking that the process that calculations sent you to that brought you to the conclusion that we were going to see the economy meltdown?
Well, I think that process really started about 10 years ago or in 2001 when in the 90s you had the tech boom, and of course that was followed by the tech bust, which was really America's first wake-up call to the types of financial shenanigans being played around the globe by the global bankers, in essence. And after that, you could watch the money transfer from the tech boom into the housing and real estate boom. And it was so, just through observing the numbers and the statistics of that and watching that boom shift from one asset class to another and knowing the real statistics, you know, the real unemployment statistics, the real inflation statistics, the real monetary supply statistics that we used to keep in this country that now you can't get the same way. You know, inflation, the consumer price index, is not calculated the way it was in 1996. It's all been changed so that it is presented well in the media.
Right, and even, as you point out, the unemployment rate, our unemployment rate is not what the unemployment rate is. They only count the people that are looking for jobs. They don't count the people that have stopped looking for employment.
Right, and there is really a good website, which is Shadow Statistics. And if you want to go look at that website, it will use the old calculations. Just, and when I mean old, I'm talking 10 years ago. And you can compare the statistics of today to the previous decade. And what you'll find out is that the unemployment rate is closer to 13%. The inflation rate is somewhere between 10 and 14%. And so just knowing those real statistics and how they affect the economy and being in business and just watching what is happening, it was only a matter of time before what happened, which was basically a global financial meltdown, you knew it was going to occur.
Well, and what you would tell me, and folks, I can verify this, that Brian has been telling me this for years, that you said it was a mathematical certainty that this would happen. But as we've been talking about in the last couple of days, even you were surprised how quickly this thing melted down.
Very surprised. I actually thought several years ago the economy would worsen and it would be a gradual decline. But a year ago, we did have a shock to the stock market a year ago this summer, and now it took one more year to finally reach a culmination point where it just basically collapsed. And it really is really simple mathematics. If you begin to study the cash outflows out of the country, the trade deficit, the annual deficit, the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare, and you look at the revenue side of the picture, taxes and inflation, and it's only a matter of time before there's just no more to pay to keep up with the rate of inflation.
This is Glenn Klein Online. We're talking with Brian Piklik, as I said, one of the outstanding libertarian thinkers in this part of the country, and frankly, in my opinion, for whatever it's worth, around the world. And there's so much to talk about, Brian, but we had some very difficult economic times that were tied into the oil supply in the 70s, 20% interest rates, unbelievable inflation. Remember Gerald Ford with the win buttons, whip inflation now? That was his big strategy. President Nixon putting price controls, price freezes on things. And yet the country came out of that. What is the difference between, let's say, the late 60s, early 70s, and what we're facing right now?
Well, the primary difference, and we could change this going forward, but it doesn't look like with our current presidential candidates that we'll have much of a choice. But the difference is in the 70s, America, all of us, took our medicine. We did that as families. We did that as business. We did that as students. And Paul Volcker was the head of the Federal Reserve, and he raised interest rates to 20%, and a severe recession followed, or we were in one, and it continued for a while until he got rid of the malinvestment, the excess debt, and people came back to more of their core economic principles. The difference now is that we don't want to face that music. We want to continue with our consumerism. We want to continue with our corporate debt, our private debt, and our family debt. And nobody wants to go through hard times. And that's what's needed, because we have to flush out that malinvestment. You know, you look at the mortgage crisis. The mortgage crisis was created by Congress. 10 years ago, they were dragging bankers and the mortgage industry up to Congress, asking them how come they weren't giving loans to people who couldn't afford them. And they came out with acts such as the Community Reinvestment Act and other mortgage lending housing acts that promoted lending to people who could not afford the mortgages that they were about to receive. Now we're being told that it was lack of regulation. Well, it wasn't lack of regulation. It was over-regulation to begin with, telling the bankers and the lenders and who to lend to. And so the media is doing a good job of presenting this as a capitalist problem, one that stems from lack of regulation, but in essence, it's the exact opposite again.
Well, you know, there's so many variables and there's so many directions that come to my mind when you talk about that. From a libertarian perspective, the closest thing that we ever had to a dictator in this country was Abraham Lincoln. He was the one that suspended the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War. He was the one that just took it upon himself. Really, he felt a call from God to keep this country together. There's nothing in the Constitution that says a state cannot leave the country. And, of course, he's considered our greatest president. And obviously he was a very fascinating historical figure, but a lot of the problems that we have to this day stem from how that was handled. And as Ron Paul, who we both supported in the Republican primary, and he was a true libertarian representative That guy took the heat. We're going to talk about Ron Paul in a second. But he pointed out that many Western civilized countries ended slavery without a civil war. And therefore, the United States theoretically could have done it too. But fast forwarding, you have the godfather of conservatism, Ronald Reagan, who never passed a balanced budget, who increased the size of government, and yet he is considered the great example for us. And then you have George W. Bush coming into office mimicking Reagan and saying that we needed to have smaller government, we needed to have a more humble foreign policy, that we should not be into nation building. And then he turns around and does the exact opposite of what he said in running for president after 9/11. What is it about getting into a position of power like that that has these guys who theoretically talk about small government, talk about less regulation, talk about a more humble foreign policy, a more constitutional or founding father-based foreign policy? The founding fathers, of course, talked about not getting entangled in foreign affairs, and we have the exact opposite. The most liberal presidential candidate could not even have dreamed of growing the government the way that George W. Bush has.
Oh, and it continues to grow. I mean, George W. Bush had a great chance to be a domestic president. If he would have stayed out of the foreign wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, he could have attended to business at home, and things in the world would be quite a bit different than they are today. Ronald Reagan was I don't consider him very conservative, really. He was a great orator,
right?
And he talked a good game. But Ronald Reagan really was the first president to set in motion the Reaganomics, the deficit spending. And it's that deficit spending and the printing of money that goes with that and the devaluing of the currency that led us to where we are today.
You are
now seeing the end result of Reaganomics.
Remember, George H.W. Bush called it voodoo economics. David, I can't think of the guy's last name, he was the manager of the budget under Reagan, came out and said that this was an ill-gotten economic policy. And, of course, we had massive deficits coming into the Clinton years. And then, but when they did lower taxes, it did increase tax revenue. And so they had this surplus, and when the Republicans took over, and they passed some more conservative-leaning things like welfare reform. Bill Clinton, of course, had his finger to the political wind, signed those bills. We had some positive things happening. And then everything went kablooey after 9/11 when, instead of being a little bit creative, thinking out of the box a little bit, basically all George W. Bush did, Brian, was put the Roman Empire foreign policy into effect. We don't like the government, we're going to take it over. We don't like what's there, we're just going to go in and take over. And now we've got the mess. That Middle East situation is going to cost us trillions, ladies and gentlemen, with a T, dollars, before this thing is over.
I'll get to that point in a minute, but earlier you said something about Bill Clinton and the reduced deficits. What you have to remember in the mid-90s is Bill Clinton was a benefactor of the internet and the wireless revolution. And so that was a tremendous boom to the economy. Businesses all over America and all states all over the world were using that internet capability, that wireless capability, to become more productive. The man hours of people at work became more productive, and this created more revenues and therefore more taxes. And so Bill Clinton and other people in office in the 90s were the benefactors of that. And now we've put most of that technology to work, and so we don't have that impetus to move forward and improve that productivity. The disturbing thing about Iraq and Afghanistan is that there's no end game. We do not have a stated final goal of when we will leave. And it really is a never-ending battle that we've entered there. And I think it's real disturbing, the two candidates, the presidential candidates that we have, their viewpoints on the war. I mean, most of America is against nation building, against these entangling alliances, trying to remove other countries, whether they be dictators, monarchies, or presidents. most Americans agree that that's not the role of the American government, and there really appears to be no end game.
Well, and the other thing that is so much different, you know, the analogies have been drawn between Iraq and Vietnam, and I think in a lot of ways, rightfully so. But the difference between Vietnam and Iraq is we are dealing with a mindset in the radical Islamic fundamentalists. They just think that they're in the middle of a couple thousand year war. I mean, they tied us back to the infidels, as they call us, from 1300 years ago. And they don't care how long it takes. And so the problem is we went in there without a strategy of what to do after the government was overthrown, without the willingness to be as tough as they are. And so they were more scared of the insurgents and the terrorists and Al-Qaeda that got infused into Iraq than they were of us. And it literally, I mean, you talk about an entanglement. This is what I believe. I believe one day that democracy will take hold in the Middle East. And in the same way that things have over a long period of time worked out in this country in race relations, we got a long way to go. It looks like we may be on the verge, amazingly, of electing the first African-American president. But Lincoln is credited with that. But so many problems came out of those decisions that were made in the 1860s. And, of course, before that, I believe George W. Bush will be looked at as a great president historically by the mainstream historians, because there will be a day that the democracy will take hold, because that is the ebb and flow of history. And this is where it all started. And in the same way that it started with Lincoln, and here we have, we're on the verge of, it looks like it's very possible, if not likely, that Barack Obama will be elected president. People look back to Lincoln, well, that's where it started. That's where the slaves were emancipated. And but in the short term, Brian, and just kind of finishing with the economic situation, it seems like socialism, state-run economic policy, has been imposed on us almost overnight. Now, I know it's been a long series of decisions, but the decisions that have been made in Europe, in the United States, as you say, with the Fed chairman, Bernanke, and the Treasury secretary, what's the guy's name?
Henry Paulson.
Yeah, Henry Paulson. The decision, and these guys are going to, well, Paulson's going to be out of office in 100 days. But the power that has been invested in Washington, literally the economic center of power, has gone from New York City, Wall Street, to Washington, seemingly overnight.
It's amazing. I did fairly well predict what was going to occur. I had no idea of the socialist solutions that would be presented by government to attempt to solve this. It's amazing. Basically, in a three-week period, we socialized our banking system, our financial system, Wall Street, the insurance companies,
the housing market.
The housing market, you know, we're assuming the toxic debt, the bad mortgages as a nation. You know, Wall Street privatized the profits. Now we're socializing the debts. So it's an amazing process that went much faster than I thought. It's really amazing. You talk about Lincoln, and then you could put FDR in the same boat. It almost appears in this country that the more you abuse the Constitution while in office as a president, the greater a president you will be in the history books. And, of course, I don't think that happens by accident, Glenn.
Why do you think that is? Is it just human nature to want to be led and to be dictated to, and that people just don't want to think for themselves? We got to remember that at the time of the American Revolution, 30% of the American population did not want to rebel against England. 30% wanted to, and 30% didn't give a rip. So it was 30% that made the decision, and obviously a decent percentage of the people that were living in the colonies at the time would have been happy to stay underneath the King of England. Is there just a human nature thing, you think, Brian, to want to be led, to want to be dictated to, and that it's a very small percentage of people that need to be well-educated and articulate and proactive that understand the value of freedom and liberty?
Oh, I think so. I think your statistics there are just about right. I'd say there's a full third of the people who do not want to go home at night and worry about who's leading them or who's in charge. They simply do not want the individual responsibility, which is what libertarianism is all about. And they just want to go home at night and get up in the morning and have their fun and go to work, and they just don't want to worry about it. But it's really amazing. I mean, I actually think the country will take some time to get back to normal, because when you socialize your financial system overnight, that is going to have far-reaching consequences for many years.
Well, and I need to also verify, folks, that as I said at the beginning of this discussion, that Brian talked about what was coming and took steps himself personally within his investments and making decisions for his company that have paid tremendous dividends. But moving forward, Brian, before we get into the presidential political situation, which is fascinating and obviously important, what would you suggest to people who, you know, have some cash on hand, are going to have cash on hand, given our current situation, what is going to be the status quo, at least for a while? What should they do with their investments? What should they do with their money? And what can we look forward to?
Well, it was really clear for the last couple of years, Glenn. And as you know, I was invested in natural resources and in silver and gold and mining stocks. But in the last 3 weeks, when we decided to actually socialize those institutions, those investment choices have become quite a bit more difficult, because it's now you have government intervention. Now you have government policies that are going to begin to dictate the economic landscape. So my advice in the next 3 months is, you know, don't be fooled by the election. Just because the stock market goes up 1,000 points in one day, don't assume that we've hit the bottom and turned past that, because the economy cannot cure itself overnight. You can't cure the economy in a day, and you can't cure the economy in a month. It's going to take a year or two to sort through these toxic mortgages, and we're going to have to see how the bailout program works. 2 weeks ago, we gave $85 billion to AIG. Last Friday, we gave AIG $35 billion more. So you can see that most likely the bailout will not work, and it will not stop the foreclosures that are occurring in America. You know, there was nothing in the bailout package that will help the average homeowner stop his foreclosure. If you're upside down in your mortgage, there was nothing in that bailout package to help you. There was nothing in the bailout package that will stop falling real estate and housing values, which is what is leading to the foreclosures. And so the bailout really was on a upper end banking scale. You know, the bailout was to forgive the banks from their mortgage debt that what was or was about to go bad. And so the root causes in the economy are still there. We still have falling home values. We still have declining real estate prices. And we still have foreclosures, I believe at the rate of about 10,000 foreclosures a day. And so, you know, this is not going to go away overnight. You have to keep your money safe, keep it somewhat liquid, and be careful.
Like the old assignment sergeant in the old show Hill Street Blues used to say, be careful out there. Well, let's talk a little bit about our presidential situation. As I said earlier, we both supported Ron Paul. I thought he did a superb job standing up to tremendous heat in the Republican Party and in the media representing libertarian values. He had tremendous response across the country, raised tremendous amounts of money, but chose just to stay in Congress, not run as either an independent or as for the Libertarian nomination, which he had done, I believe, in 1988. And he is the lone representative, seemingly, in the United States Congress speaking to Libertarian viewpoint. Before we get into Obama and McCain, talk about what you think about Ron Paul and what he's represented coming initially doing some pioneer work, coming out of the wake of Harry Brown, and what he means just to have a lone voice speaking in the wilderness like that.
Well, I think Ron Paul was the most refreshing person to hit politics in my lifetime, actually. To actually watch him be able to participate in the debates was very refreshing. He harnessed the internet, had record fundraising days, record fundraising quarters. I think it was in the last quarter of last year he led all Republican candidates in fundraising. And he did get into debates, which opened up a lot of people's eyes. They were able to hear him and watch him on TV and learn his principles. But you can go back to Ron Paul in 2002 and 2003 and 2004, and you can read his congressional testimony. And he warned very accurately what would happen in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what he predicted is true today. He warned also about the money supply and inflation and the unsound economic policies that we were, the printing of money and the devaluing of the currency and the malinvestment that was being created in the economy. And 3 or 4 years later, it's true today. And that's all in the congressional record. Now, he's been very consistent. You can go on the internet and listen to his interviews from 1988 when he ran as a libertarian. And his message is very consistent. It's the same then as it is today. And so that's refreshing. But I think Ron Paul knew all along that he wasn't going to win. Ron Paul knew that what he was going to do was try to provide a site and a source for people to learn as these problems developed, that he could bring people to the libertarian philosophy. And that movement is growing. At his convention in Minneapolis, he had 12,000 people attended a counter convention of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and that wasn't even covered by the media. Could you imagine if there was a counter convention of any other viewpoint? I watched that thing closely. There was no coverage of it.
Amazing. And if Hillary Clinton had 12,000 people show up to a convention, it would be on the news for 3 or 4 days straight. But once the convention was over, or even about the month before, he formed the Campaign for Liberty, and his goal was to have 100,000 people sign up on that website, and he met his goal. Now, 100,000 people, that's a lot of people, Glenn. And so, you know, he has raised the awareness of the libertarian philosophy and the limited government philosophies that he promotes, and I think he's done America a lot of good.
I agree, but you talked about the socialization of the economy and what's happened literally overnight, and I really believe it had a lot to do with the information age that we lived in. I mean, literally, we were experiencing this second by second. I mean, people are watching the stock market go down, and people are watching our stock market go down in Hong Kong and the European markets and all over the world. So it fueled this fire, and the response to it was also able to be so quickly addressed because of the information age. Do you think that could be part of the remedy as well? Because this has got to be a grassroots movement, but with the internet, with instant communication, and if people get fed up enough, I mean, if you elect a few more Ron Pauls into Congress, you elect a governor here or there, perhaps things could turn around faster than we think, because of the way the thing turned around so quickly from the negative standpoint.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think it was Sam Adams that said, you know, we don't need a majority. We just need a small minority who is really set on a certain set of goals that works to achieve that goal. The alternative forms of media definitely have helped. Ron Paul harness the internet like nobody has before. And shows like yours. And so, you know, I don't get my news from the nightly news anymore. I have my internet websites that I use where I can get the actual facts. I read the news that is the news that I'm looking for. And it's helping. I think the freedom movement is growing. Unfortunately, the socialist movement is in charge. And they're progressing farther every day. But I do think the freedom movement is growing.
Well, we're certainly involved in some very interesting times. I remember after the 2000 election, or even before it, thinking, and I remember sitting around our family dinner table thinking, boy, you know, my kids and your kids, Brian, that this is such a boring time to be alive, and you know, just nothing's happening, and nothing like the 60s or the 70s, and you know, the Cold War is over, and there's no more Soviet Union, and everything is just going to be boring. Well, history is replete with surprises. We've got two presidential candidates. Ironically, you've got the most liberal Democrat candidate, certainly since George McGovern, in some ways fiscally more liberal than George McGovern was. And the Republicans end up picking John McCain, who clearly was the most regulation-oriented Republican in the contest. He ends up elevating over everybody else. So you've got a tremendous contrast from the standpoint you've got this war hero, 72-year-old man who's got a tremendous life experience against a 46-year-old or 47, however old Obama is, guy that's really been in the Senate for not even one term, and he's been running for president for 2 years. In some ways, the contrast couldn't be any starker, and yet both these guys, we know, we've given their histories and their stated policies, are going to grow the government more.
They're both going to grow the government more. They're both going to need more tax revenues for their programs. Both of them are out on the campaign trail promising people things that we can't afford to pay for. Barack's probably ahead in that department. He proposes new programs every day. But there is no choice between the two candidates. And unless we as Americans face that fact, then it won't change, because the Democrats and Republicans are good at working together. You might get socialized medicine faster under a Democratic regime, or you might get Democratic medicine slower under a Republican regime, but our medicine, you know, our healthcare system in America is heading towards socialization. And you look at the two candidates on their major issues. We now have a candidate from each party that believes that all global warming is human-induced. Neither one recognizes at all the historical weather patterns or the effects of the universe and the Earth's atmosphere on the environment. And so they're both for a cap-and-trade global emission system, which is going to be nothing but a regulatory scheme to make money and create tax revenue. Both candidates supported the bailout plan, so we had no choice there. They were both for it. And that's interesting because they were both in Congress and helped pass the laws that created it, so they're both for the government fixing it. And John McCain wants to tax you at 25%, and Barack Obama wants to tax you at 27%. It seems to me a real presidential election would debate whether we should have an income tax at all.
Well, and that was one thing that happened, and I believe that was the libertarian influence on the Republicans. You had Mike Huckabee, who did well for a little while, the former governor of Arkansas, proposing no income tax and a flat tax. Of course, that came directly what's called the fair tax from Neil Bortz, who wrote two best-selling books on that, who is a more libertarian-leaning talk show host in Atlanta, and, of course, Ron Paul speaking out. If people, Brian, actually knew what they paid in taxes, we'd have another Boston Tea Party. I mean, they talk about, you know, income tax at the top level being 39%. If people actually understood how many hidden taxes are out there, what have your calculations shown that the average American pays in taxes?
55%. And it's amazing, but it just continues to climb. The hidden taxes, the different fees, the different regulatory, you know, all the corporations are paying huge regulatory taxes that no one knows about. It's in the form of regulation. But we calculate the tax rate, you know, for the average person to be around 55%. And there really is no difference between the two candidates, and I just can't stress that enough. We're arguing about peanuts, really. I mean, the whole system, Democrat, Republican, is made to divide and conquer the American people into two camps. And that way we spend our time fighting each other rather than working together.
You know, there really is no difference. We have one political party. We just have a left wing and a right wing and a lot of people in between. And of course, the political issue that divides the Republicans and Democrats most strongly is the issue of abortion. And I've often thought that we have a solution to abortion, and it's just a scientific solution, which is if a president would take the same type of leadership that John F. Kennedy did in getting us to the moon by the end of the 1960s and say, by the year 2018, let's have a situation where the pregnancy can be terminated without destroying the life. There are so many parents out there, or potential parents, who want to adopt children, but they can't get pregnant. And so they have to go to Romania and to China and to all these places to adopt kids. So you can have a compromise on abortion by having the scientific wherewithal to allow the pregnancy to be terminated without ending the life. Then that eliminates basically any major difference between the Republicans and Democrats. Then it becomes a situation between people who are into government regulation and government control and a socialistic leaning policy and libertarianism and freedom and liberty leaning people. Do you see that coming anytime soon where the folks that are part of this 100,000 member drive that Ron Paul did are raising up and forming a viable party to compete with the Democrats, or like we like to call it, the Republicrats, this one party? The Republicans and Democrats have really conspired together to keep a third party from ever being able to elevate on any very serious level.
Well, as I said before, I think the freedom movement is growing. I think the people reading on the internet, listening to internet radio, you know, there's a whole other media source out there now that is being used to educate children and college students and high school students and adults. And so I think people are becoming more aware of the government policies and the effects that they have. But it's going to take a while. I don't actually think one of the existing parties today can do it. I think you would actually have to have a almost a crisis of sorts like we've just had with the economic policies. And I often thought it should be called America's Party, and it should follow the Constitution, and you would need to solve the abortion issue. That's one of the most decisive issues in America that splits America right down the middle and divides people into two camps, and they happen to be the Republican camp and the Democratic camp, and after that point, nothing gets done because they want those issues to take people's focus and attention away from what is really happening inside the government. And it's interesting. I was really intrigued by Ron Paul's run for the presidency, and I watched it and stayed up all night when he was raising $6 million a day. And I actually traveled to Iowa to the caucuses that were held in Iowa, attended that event just to watch how the first state in the nation would handle it. And then as we moved into the primaries and watched the debates, it's interesting, except for Ron Paul, because he stayed till the end. But the candidates that thought the most like I did were the ones that were eliminated first. And in each case, in each party, I believe we ended up with the worst candidate. I believe Barack Obama is, you know, he is quite a bit left. Even for a lot of his own party, I mean, he would not fit well with the Blue Dog Democrats of the past. And John McCain fits the same mold, is that he has done many things in his career that do not align with the Republican Party. And so I just think it's interesting that both candidates, in my opinion, would have probably been my last two choices.
Well, I think the American Party is a great name, but I think we should call it the Pitlick Party. Because if there's one thing that I know is the Pitlicks know how to throw a party. You know what I'm saying? So this is Glenn Cloud Online. We're talking with Brian Pitlick, the president of Pitlick & Wick up here in northern Wisconsin, speaking to you from an undisclosed location. 2 or 3 weeks from tomorrow is the presidential election. And I want to get your prediction first, but before, or second. But before we do, Joe Biden was Barack Obama's choice for vice president, and he had said an incredible number of gaffes. I mean, if Sarah Palin had the amount of gaffes that this senator who's been in the Senate for almost 40 years had had, she would have been maybe thrown off the ticket. But one thing that he said that I thought was absolutely incredible, that he literally equated paying higher taxes with patriotism. And I thought it was incredible that here is a guy running for the vice presidency of the United States in a country that was founded on a tax revolt. And those were the patriots, the ones that were against paying taxes without representation. And now he's equating, and by the way, apparently getting away with it, with equating higher taxes or being willing to pay higher taxes with patriotism. It is, you talk about something being turned on its head and being upside down, it's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. I think the Boston Tea Party, I think the tax rate on the tea was somewhere around 1.5%.
3%.
Yeah, 2 or 3%, if I'm not mistaken. And now we're being told that, you know, if you add up all the property taxes and the gas taxes and the cigarette taxes and the tobacco and alcohol and property taxes and all the hidden taxes, were around 55%. We actually have a vice presidential candidate running on the premise of paying more taxes. And not only that, we, you know, that we should feel good about it, but it's patriotic. And that's a staggering concept.
You know, the most amazing thing, of course, is that the party that promotes higher taxes the most is the Democrat Party. Now, the Republicans have done just fine with raising taxes and growing the government. We've demonstrated that on previous shows and certainly on this one. But there is nothing prohibiting guys like Warren Buffett or Bill Maher, who I enjoy watching his program on HBO, these multimillionaire liberals from Hollywood. There is absolutely nothing prohibiting them paying higher taxes. If they're so for it, why don't they just voluntarily pay more taxes into the government coffers?
Well, and after all, the actual tax code does say it's voluntary. So there is actually nothing more disturbing to me than to watch a wealthy capitalist who grew up in the system, use capitalism to become wealthy, then testify in front of Congress that the average working American should pay more in taxes. I actually can't even grasp that happens. Warren Buffett comes to mind. And if Warren Buffett thinks that's such a good idea, he could liquidate it, some or all of his stocks tomorrow, and he could help with the national bailout. I mean, he's one of the few people in America that would actually have the financial wherewithal to help. But you'll notice he doesn't do that, and none of the other Hollywood elite that professes that faith does it either. And it's amazing to watch that happen.
So we're 3 weeks out, and it seems like that our presidents are always the answer to the last president. After, of course, Nixon and Ford, then you had Carter trying to clean up and being this, Christian man from the South with, you know, these high moral values, and all of a sudden he comes out and he said that he's committed adultery in his heart. And then, of course, the Carter presidency was an absolute disaster. And then out of that, and when Carter talking about the malaise that the country was in, you have Ronald Reagan, who stands up for the city on a hill. And then out of Reagan, we basically had a third term of Reagan and George H.W. Bush, who was not a good communicator. He was not the great communicator, but he went back on his pledge. I mean, he famously stood up in his campaign at the Republican National Convention and said, "Read my lips, no new taxes," and then he raised taxes. And then here comes a sharp, well-spoken guy, Bill Clinton, cleans his clock, beats Bob Dole again, for the second term. And then George W. Bush comes in there promising to restore honor and dignity to the White House, which, of course, is exactly the opposite of what has happened. And you talk about a guy who is not a great communicator. I mean, he may be. He is. He is the worst speaker and orator of any president, certainly since radio and television was invented. And now you've got another great communicator coming, who's sharp and who's hip. He's seems incredibly open-minded, where Bush was stubborn. And then you got McCain, who was the maverick that Bush beat in the 2000 primaries, that amazingly comes back from political death. He was on literally a death watch in his campaign to win the Republican nomination. What do you think is going to happen 3 weeks from tomorrow?
Well, before the last 3 weeks, when McCain chose Palin, I thought that was a pretty smart choice on his part because he energized his base, and he needed that. But in the last 3 weeks, with what's happened in the stock market and the economy and the bailout plan and the socialization of our financial system, I cannot see how the economy in this case would not win out. I think Barack Obama will win with 375 to 400 electoral votes, and I think it's the economy.
Well, there's one great thing about Barack Obama. Other than he's cool, he's hip, he's got a hot-looking wife. He's a Bears fan, so not all is lost, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so I've got the slogan for the new political. It's the Pitlick Party, Prosperity for the People.
That sounds fine.
Pitlicks, Pitlicks, Pitlicks. Brian, I can't thank you enough for your time and your insight. And, you know, I tell you, I remember right after 9/11 coming up here, and, of course, we were in Tampa during much of the year, and that's where CENTCOM is, Central Command in Tampa and MacDill Air Force Base. And we were really affected by it in Tampa, as all the urban areas. And I remember asking you, were you scared? Were you upset? And you were like, no, I was interested, I was concerned, but there's something about a more rural lifestyle that you guys have had a tremendous influence in county politics up here and in living out a more libertarian lifestyle. When you get the further away from Washington that you get, it seems like even though everything's going crazy, you can still kind of live at least a more freedom-leaning lifestyle.
Oh, I think that's definitely true, Glenn. Just being living in more rural America, you tend to follow the libertarian philosophy, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, independent, or libertarian. It's just the way rural life is. For example, when you have a recession is generally not felt in a rural area as much as it is in an urban area, because, you know, the urban areas are a more fast-paced economy where everything is dependent upon the thing before it. And in the rural economies, you have industrial logging, or you have farming, or you have mining, and it is a different economy, and it's a different way of life. But I think you're right. We are less affected by some of these national crises like 9/11 or the current economic trouble that we're looking at. And I think overall, you know, I don't think we want to, or I certainly don't want to, and I know you don't, we don't want to promote a negative outlook either. I think you and I are both looking at this and saying, well, we don't like the way it's going. We don't necessarily like who's in charge, but yet we're trying to do our part and build that freedom movement to head in a different direction. So you have to get up every day and take an optimistic attitude towards it and work to change it, and that's what I try and do.
In closing, you mentioned a couple websites earlier, Brian, but for our listeners, what are some of the other websites that you use as a resource and that people can go to and find the facts and find the information and as you said, even the inspiration to keep on plugging towards a more freedom-based economy and political system?
Well, I like the one new, it's an email newsletter. One of the groups that Harry Brown started was Downsize DC, and that's a great tool, internet tool. They give you a email once a day or once every 2 days on efforts being put together on a national level to downsize DC. And the focus there is mainly on the congressional process to have better rules, better bills presented. For example, they have a bill that they're promoting that's one bill at a time, so that we don't have four different types of bills being worked on together. So So Downsize DC is one group that I like to listen to. Personally, I'm involved with Americans for Prosperity, which is a financially, fiscally conservative group that focus on, you know, fiscal conservatism at the government level. Shadow Statistics is a website that you can use to get real facts and figures on the economy and statistics like inflation and unemployment and the money supply and the producer price index and things like that. So there's three that you can use that are a pretty good source, and they've been around for a while.
And if you're looking to build a highway or driveway in northern Wisconsin, PitlickandWick.com. That's the president of Pitlick and Wick, one of the great libertarian thinkers and spokesmen in this part of the world, Mr. Brian Pitlick. Brian, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure. Let's do it after the election and see what's up.
Sure, anytime, Glenn. That'd be great.
That's Brian Pitlick. I want to thank Sean O'Halloran for producing and engineering this effort. Until next time, from the undisclosed location, this is Glenn Klein Online saying, Shalom, everybody!